Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Delafield by Catherine V. Forrest, narrated by Kate Zane. 1. May 2012. Joe, another one just arrived, Kate Delafield said, gripping her cell phone as she paced her living room. Did you send it on? Detective Joe Cameron had picked up her call on his private line at Victorville PD as if he'd been waiting for it. Just now.
Hold on a sec. Got it.
He muttered.
Looks like she's escalating.
Kate strode to the breakfast bar and looked down at the handwritten note she'd taken out of her mailbox, photographed, and forwarded to Cameron. She read it aloud. Any minute now will be your last. That's about as escalated as it gets. Before she kills me, of course.
Our offer stands.
His voice was harsh with exasperation.
You have your whole police family behind you on this, Kate.
I know, I'm grateful. But we both know assigning protection is a waste. She figures to just wait it out. Nevertheless, and certainly at his behest, patrol cars drifted past her house every few hours. In her view, they served only to draw unwanted attention, and she felt exposed enough out here in the high desert.
Yeah, well, Cameron said, she might get tired of waiting it out.
Joe, I'm armed, alarmed, and on film. This way I won't endanger anyone else. This way, I'm not doing anything different from how you hold up to wait for your brother. Blunt reminder of the choice he'd made a few years back when she'd helped him protect his family in a cabin not too far from here. There's something new, is why I called. A Yucca Valley postmark.
Jesus. Did you save the envelope?
She shook her head at this rote question. It hardly needs analysis or fingerprinting. We know it's Ellie Schuster. She heard Cameron draw a breath. They'd worked together so many years she held a clear image of him at his desk in the Victorville patrol station, unchanged from their days together as homicide detectives at LAPD's Wilshire Division. His jacket off and hung on the back of his chair, tie loosened, sleeves of a crisp shirt rolled tidily up to the elbow, holding his cell phone to his ear with an index finger, head bent, making notes as he listened.
Kate, he said, it's more than just the envelope and you know it. Coming from out of town, there was always the possibility
that, like most threats, they were just threats. Kate finished for him. She knew better. Had known from the start this was as real as death. So now she's right here. The missives, this one being number 13, had previously been sent from 7 different California postmarks in roughly 2-week intervals over the past 5 months, all handwritten in brief, stark variations of the same message. Eleanor Frances Schuster's only remaining purpose on this earth was to remove Kate Delafield from it.
At least we can pinpoint some action. Put out another bolo, check out all the local hotels and motels, distribute a circular with her photo.
Kate felt a scintilla of hope about a wide area beyond the lookout, but it faded quickly. There had been no sighting of Ellie Schuster for 5 months. She had left no electronic footprints. She was now operating untraceably on a cash basis with money awarded to her by the state. She could be anywhere in the high desert, the entire Coachella Valley, even right there in Victorville with Cameron. She could be in disguise. Using her prison connections, she might have arranged for a hitman as a proxy. And if so, anyone Kate met on the street could be her killer.
What's it been?
He was saying.
1.5 years.
About that since her release. 5 months and a week since the letter started.
What took her so long? That's what I can't figure, even factoring in her wait for the reparations payoff.
The rage was building, is my guess.
She had 19 years for that, he argued. Kate, you seem way too, I don't know, unruffled over a case that was a total Tory Holden fuck-up. Believe me, Joe, I'm ruffled. It doesn't matter about Tori. I was the D3, she was a D1. The case was my responsibility. I suspected she was a fuck-up before she proved it the hard way. Kate flexed the shoulder that reminded her daily of an arrest gone south in every dimension, including the death of the 17-year-old suspect and a crossfire bullet that had put her down and on leave for 6 weeks. A bullet that came from the weapon of then-partner Tori Holden. Besides, Tori's out of the frame, long since dead of breast cancer.
It was a strong case even without her mess-up, Cameron retorted. Incriminating diary, motive, testimony.
She gritted her teeth. He would not let go of his determination to persuade her into absolving herself of any blame. Like everyone else, he had no inkling of her actual culpability in Ellie Schuster's wrongful conviction. She tossed the note back onto the counter, wishing that instead of giving in to her electric fear when she saw the postmark, the need to immediately share with him this newest and most alarming communication, she'd ripped up the goddamn thing and thrown it into the desert winds. She said flatly, "We put the wrong person on death row. Destroyed her marriage. Took 19 years from her life."
"The jury did. It took the Innocence Project."
"Yes, yes, I know.
Getting the case reviewed with new evidence and reneged testimony, which you had no way of knowing back then."
How many times did he have to repeat all this? She'd read through the trial transcripts and appeals, examined her copy of the murder book innumerable times, run over it in her mind 1,000 more times looking for anything that might have been missed. If Ellie Schuster hadn't done this crime, who did? "Joe, I know all this, and so does she. It makes no difference. She's out to have someone else know how it feels to have their life torn up the way we did hers. Feel what it's like to be on death row."
"Amy would..."
"Leave Amy the hell out of this!" A song from the radio next door suddenly impinged on her consciousness, and she involuntarily laughed.
"What is so goddamn funny?" Cameron snapped.
"Music from next door." "The police. Every breath you take, I'll be watching you."
"Yeah, that's really funny. How's your sobriety?"
"Holding," she said shortly, irked by the question, an unwelcome reminder of what had been out of her awareness, however momentarily.
"How about I come over to see you tonight?"
"Be glad to see you anytime, Joe, you know that." She clicked off. Mostly anytime. Mostly she could do without his useless, hovering anxiety. She began to pace her house, her go-to routine in confronting the renewed ache and craving for the soul-deep soothe of alcohol. She gazed at the tile flooring, beige tinged with coral, that she'd installed throughout and splashed with woven Native American scatter rugs. At her armchairs-only living room, all four of them in pale pastel shades and with ottomans, the angular glass coffee table and end tables, the mounted TV on a wall she'd painted sunset citrus, the two other walls layered in rough-hewn shelves crowded with books. The kitchen alcove with its breakfast bar, ruthlessly utilitarian, as were the two bedrooms, basic bed and dresser in each, and with another complement of books. She liked looking at, savoring this house, the first place she'd created just for herself. Never mind the monetary cost, its much higher cost emotionally. Everything in here was hers, her choice, no compromise. If her life was to be taken away, let it be here with Joshua trees and desert winds as her companions. And when it happened, just let it be quick. Infinitesimally lightened by the survey of her house, she moved to the front window and went through her next checklist, the practical one, less comforting. Minimal danger from the left, a rock formation that could be navigated only with boulders noisily breaking loose underfoot.
neighbors to her right, all of them familiar if not personally known to her. Beyond the back deck, a few widely scattered dwellings, then open desert extending for miles to Joshua Tree National Park. Before her, rocky sand patchworked with cactus, choya, ocotillo. Across the road, a purely desert vista of Joshua trees, creosote, chaparral, and brittle bush overseen by the far-distant San Bernardino Mountains. Not in view, but much in her awareness, were the police-mounted rooftop cameras that rotated front and back of the house and one above the front door, the alarms active on windows and doors. Motion-activated lighting that at night would wash the house in illumination at the approach of an intruder. All of it solid protection unless she left the house. She could be shot on the way to her Jeep. But she was always armed, and the shooter would be starkly visible on this desert landscape. Not that it mattered. She guessed that Ellie Schuster, if she performed the act herself, would want to be clearly visible whenever she finally acted. Kate was in the kitchen removing the cap on a bottle of Teavana iced tea when a vehicle drove up. No mistaking that it had stopped in her driveway. She heard every sound with distinct clarity here in a silence broken only by capricious wind, the drone of an occasional aircraft, the song track from next door. Moments later, a knock at her door. Ellie Schuster, finally coming to kill her. 2. Kate assessed the slender, deeply tanned woman standing on her doorstep. From the coif of blonde hair that framed a hawkish, skillfully made-up face, the crimson sleeveless silk tunic over black tights and weighted down with gold chains, the waft of perfume, she guessed Palm Springs. Or Beverly Hills. Under the makeup and bleach, sun damage exposed a woman in her 60s, and no killer or solicitor or Jehovah's Witness was she. A Mercedes convertible with dealer plates glowed candy apple red behind her own Jeep on the crushed stone lane comprising her driveway. Having completed her own inspection of Kate in one raking glance, the woman announced in a smoker's voice, "I'm Geneva Fallon. Could I have a few minutes of your time? Alice Bannon suggested you might be good for me to talk to." "Alice?" This did not compute. "Of course. How is she?" She stepped back to allow Geneva Fallon into her living room, recalling that a Christmas card from her LAPD colleague from the early days had been their last contact, 5 months ago. "Fine, she's fine," the woman replied, stepping over the threshold. "Retired, of course, but you would know that. Alice asked me to give you her regards." A smile added considerable wattage to her face and persona, and Kate smiled back, not so much at her as at the surfacing memory from when she and the then recently appointed Sheriff Alice Bannon of the coastal town of Seacrest had together exposed a disappearance as a murder. Geneva Fallon's bona fides were solid. "I apologize for dropping in on you like this," Fallon said, glancing around her. "But frankly, I thought if I phoned, you'd just hang up thinking I was a robocall, or a nutcase. I've come from Palm Springs," she concluded, as if the one-hour drive were a Herculean trek. The words Alice Bannon would have been just as effective on the phone, and this clearly intelligent, expensively turned-out woman surely knew it. A display of wealth and self-assurance optimized an in-person approach for whatever this was about, and Kate was intrigued. It would be at least a distraction from constant disquiet over sobriety and mortality. "Very nice," Fallon commented, gesturing to the wide picture window and the San Bernardino Mountains in purple-beige definition under whipped cream clouds. She slowly surveyed the two walls of books, nodding as if something had been confirmed for her. There was no hum from the air conditioning unit. The house was comfortable enough with morning air. From the radio next door came the raucous voice of Tina Turner demanding "What's Love Got to Do with It?" less audible when Kate closed the door. She settled herself in her usual chair, surreptitiously pulling the .38 from the back of her khakis and tucking it behind her armchair pillow. Fallon lowered herself into the pale green armchair opposite her, sending another wave of perfume her way, and placed her Gucci handbag on the floor, the gold ornamentation around her neck and wrists so heavy the chains and bracelets shifted in delayed reaction. She slung her feet up onto the ottoman, multicolored rhinestone straps of her sandals glittering. Raising her eyes from the costly footwear, Kate met a shrewd, dark brown gaze and open scrutiny of her. Fallon's hands were in her lap, the fingers of each hand flashing with diamond and ruby rings, fingernails manicured and shiny swirls of orange and red to match her toenails. Fallon, as in Talon, Kate thought as she focused on those fingers, certain she was far from the first person to come up with the rhyme. So far, the woman fit every stereotype of Palm Springs' wealth, privilege, and fierce determination to hold on to every remnant of youth. But this much effortful display on a Monday morning was impressive enough that Kate felt vaguely gratified by her own accidental choice of one of her newer polo shirts to go with freshly pressed khakis, choices she'd made for her appointment today in Los Angeles. "You're from Seacrest, then?" Kate ventured, although she could not imagine this obvious sun worshiper ever living in a foggy oceanside town. Fallon flicked that away with two flame-tipped fingers. "God, no. Alice and I were at UCLA together. We've been friends ever since." "Why?" Kate wondered. Why on earth would the Alice Bannon she knew, the bluff, no-nonsense sheriff of a quiet little Northern California town, a declared lesbian, maintain a decades-long friendship with this ostentatious woman? Fallon addressed Kate in a quiet, husky tone.
"I'm hoping you can give me some help. I'm recently widowed, and my husband left a considerable estate, enough that I can make financial amends to someone."
Kate asked, puzzled. "You need help with that?"
"I need a go-between. To get it done. To get it to her."
"I take it there's a reason you can't make the approach directly." Fallon emitted a sarcastic snort.
"You take it exactly right. I tried to. She was... Can you imagine anyone turning away no strings cash?"
Kate shrugged. "Sure. Drug money. Stolen money. There was no such thing as no strings money. It always changed hands for a reason." She felt a pulse of admiration for the woman who had rejected Geneva Fallon and however much of her no-strings cash. Affluent people tended to possess supreme confidence that money solved any problem, including the salving of conscience. Poor people were left to trust in God for salvation or punishment, or in criminal cases, black-robed judges. For some crimes, no reparation was ever possible, and even God's will be done became inexplicable as to what God's will could possibly have been. Geneva Fallon had leaned over to retrieve something from her Gucci bag, and coldly, Kate contemplated her. What had this woman done? Why had Alice sent her? Under the poise conferred by wealth and grooming, she appeared to have been quite a looker in her day, the usual requisite for marrying into wealth. Had there been a lesbian connection between this woman and the party she was trying to pay off? That cliché of the lesbian world. A straight Geneva Fallon experimenting with a woman, with a foreordained, equally clichéd outcome. As if she were back in an LAPD interview room, Kate took the lead. "Let's begin with her name." Fallon handed her a photograph she'd taken from her purse and leaned back.
"Natalie Rostow."
She shifted in the chair and for the first time looked ill at ease. Kate glanced at the image of a gray-haired, thin-faced, unremarkable woman, perhaps a few years older than herself, placed the photo on the end table next to her, then asked, "And the reason for this animosity toward you?"
"Kate, may I call you Kate? Please call me Geneva."
Kate nodded, and Fallon lowered her sandals to the tiled floor and clasped her hands as she leaned forward and said earnestly,
"No one else in my life knows about this except Alice."
She gazed at Kate as if in supplication.
"I assume you know the film The Children's Hour."
Of course she knew it. "Lillian Hellman," she said, her nerves flaring alert, and gestured to her bookshelves. "The play's in there somewhere. Also Scoundrel Time by the same author, a memoir relevant to a long-ago homicide investigation with roots in the days of the Hollywood blacklist." The Children's Hour, a notorious sensation in its day, had informed her adolescence, and then a 12-year relationship. Far too much of her life with its powerful message about the cost of lesbian exposure. Fallon raised her eyebrows at this definitive knowledge.
"I didn't see the movie till the 80s, or I might have learned something, but it was too late."
"Too late," Kate repeated. She already knew where this was going. The knuckles of Fallon's clasped hands whitened.
"I like to think it would have made a difference, but I was such a nasty little bitch."
She took in and released a breath.
"Since you know the story, then you'll understand what I mean when I say I was Mary."
The two major characters, she remembered, were Martha and Karen, which meant that Mary... Hackles rising, Kate asked carefully, "You spread lies about two teachers being lesbians?"
"Just one teacher. It was actually the truth."
Her mouth tightened, her eyes dark pools of pained memory.
"There were six of us, a high school wolf pack. We called ourselves the Six Shooters. Everyone was petrified of us, even the teachers. Susan Ricks was our ringleader, died years ago."
She grimaced.
"Bowel cancer. Fitting."
Again she shifted in her chair, and Kate offered, feeling obligated, "Can I get you anything? Iced tea? Water?" Fallon waved that away, intent on getting her story out, continuing in a rush of words.
"Natalie Rostow was our sophomore year English teacher. I could see her backyard from a corner of my upstairs bedroom window. I saw her kissing another woman in what she believed was complete privacy."
Her raspy voice trembled.
"I took Polaroids."
Kate stirred in her chair as inchoate memory surfaced from her time with Anne, her own tightly closeted years in the military and police worlds. "I take it she lost her job."
"Her job?"
Fallon blinked several times.
"I can only wish it were just that one job. This was before Anita Bryant and all the Save the Children business, before firing gay teachers made the California ballot."
"You don't know what happened to her?" Fallon's face was grim.
"I do know. Nothing good. Today she's in Desert Hot Springs, living in a trailer park."
She might be there because of any number of life choices, Kate thought, but did not offer this potential comfort. Fallon's mouth formed into a moo.
"Natalie Rostow would tear me limb from limb if she knew I had a private detective keeping tabs on her. But I'm just trying to fix this."
Fix this. Gripping the arms of her chair, Kate had to look away. Anita Bryant happened in 1977, so this must have been in the early to mid-70s. No one knew better than she did how life had been like back then, for her and Anne. This woman actually thought she could do something to fix the life she'd laid waste to. Fallon saw or sensed something in Kate's body language because she spread her jeweled hands placatingly.
I know I've been on the wrong side of gay rights.
Kate turned that away with an abrupt raising of both hands, uncaring about her graceless reaction. Yet another mea culpa about to spill from a heterosexual. She asked curtly, what changed you?
Seeing that film. And Alice. Mostly Alice.
She continued awkwardly.
It took me years to tell her about this. She's always been so strong. Such integrity, such a leader. In college, I just threw myself at her, trying to atone. I'm not sure she ever really understood or welcomed friendship from me.
Undoubtedly not, Kate thought. Alice must have been at pains to endure a woman so antithetical to her values and unpretentious way of life.
But I respect her more than just about anybody I've ever known. Better late than never, I guess.
Kate did not reply to this homily. Before the sea change in the culture of the country with domestic partnerships and the 2008 California marriages, the Fallons of the world had never questioned the cultural consensus around them, the vicious contempt and homicidal attacks on sexual difference. Took no notice of the bodies that lay strewn in the wake of that hatred. Few today had any concept of the courage it had taken to confront such animosity. The cost in lost jobs, families, lives. God knew she'd never had such courage, and her cowardice adhered to her like a burial shroud. These days, nothing enraged her more than straight people smiling their existential tolerance.
We didn't enslave you, didn't herd you into concentration camps. We're even starting to accept you now, right? So you're winning.
Get over yourself, Kate ordered, returning her attention to Geneva Fallon. At least this woman, for one, was attempting some sort of a make-good. Dust in the wind was mournfully emanating from next door, and Fallon was gazing in irritation out the front window as if in search of its origin. She said to Kate,
"Does that music go on all the time? How can you stand it?"
"It's the soundtrack of my life." She smiled. "You're right. I should go next door and tell the woman." Fallon managed an awkward smile in return and again looked at the bookshelves.
"Quite a collection."
"A friend bequeathed most of them to me," Kate said, flicking a glance at the shiny brass urn and ceramic coffee mug resting amid a select grouping of books, trying to imagine what Maggie would have made of this woman across from her. "What did you say to Natalie Rostow? What did she say to you? She recognized you after all this time?" Fallon answered tonelessly.
"Knew me in an instant. I got to say I was sorry and offered her money, and all she did was scream at me to get out, get out, get out."
"She knew clearly what you were there for." A rhetorical question. She would have reacted the same way to this monster out of her worst nightmares. She nodded.
"I tried to give her the cashier's check, but this mannish old woman came limping out from somewhere and grabbed me and shoved me out the door. Slammed it so hard the trailer all but came down."
"You can't accept that. Let it go?"
"I accept that she won't have anything to do with me," Fallon said, lowering her gaze to the tile floor. "I don't accept that I still can't help her."
Kate looked at her with a glimmer of respect.
"Barbara Jameson, her partner, must have been very sick," Fallon was saying in another raspy rush of words. "She died a month ago, and now Natalie Rostow's an old woman all alone in a decrepit trailer. We both know how it is to be old anywhere in this country, much less isolated and dirt poor. I could be living right next door to her if I hadn't married a man who'd just got himself into the oil business. We moved here from Bakersfield."
She looked up at Kate.
"I live in old Las Palmas now."
Kate had been in Palm Springs often enough over the years to recognize the legendary area where 50s-era film stars
Sample complete. Ready to continue?